For God's sake, let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the deaths of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war.
Ay me, I see the ruin of my house. The tiger now hath seized the gentle hind. Insulting tyranny begins to jut upon the innocent and aweless throne.
What is a man? Sure he made us with such large discourse, looking before and after, gave us not that capability and godlike reason to fust in us unused.
O my dear father, restoration hang thy medicine on my lips, and let this kiss repair those violent harms that my two sisters have in thy reverence made.
I am a king that find thee, and I know 'tis not the balm, the sceptre and the ball, the sword, the mace, the crown imperial, the throne he sits on, nor the pomp that beats on the high shore of the world.
This is the mighty history of the British Empire, a people living on a tiny island in the North Atlantic Ocean. Built an empire that circled the earth and brought freedom and education to languishing millions. This empire was blessed by Almighty God and one of his best educated teachers, William Shakespeare. Shakespeare has educated some of the greatest leaders of all time, such as Abraham Lincoln and Winston Churchill.
We shall never surrender.
Our troubled world needs a fresh crew of nation-building leaders. Are you ready to step up to the challenge? Welcome to the exciting classroom of Shakespeare's Royal Education with host Dennis Leap.
Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome back to Shakespeare's Royal Education. And I am absolutely stunned that I have a comment. And actually, I feel bad for this fellow because I'll just read it all to you, author. He says, "Before starting, Richard II, I sent you a comment, but it seems you didn't get it. For that reason, I'm sending it again. See below. It's a screenshot of the message. Beneath the below comment is another comment composed today." So I'm getting two comments out of one. So this is from Andre, and I'm going to tell Andre that I'm really sorry I didn't get it. Sometimes I get things and I don't look at them, and so I'm sorry about that. But he goes on, he says, "Hello, I just wanted to send you a quick note to let you know I'm still in the classroom learning about leaderships as you take us through the pages of King John." And so this goes back, you know, a whole other series of programs. "Is it possible to teach us from Richard III or Henry V next?" And so actually, Andre, we're doing Richard II. And I'm not sure if there is a Richard III, but there's Richard II. And yes, there's a lot to learn from him. He says, "As always, thank you for delivering us a royal education." And he says, "Your front row student." So he goes on now. This is part two. So I'm really, really happy. Happy, Andre. He says, "I still faithfully listen to every episode, but due to my employment, I've been able to write as frequently as I would like. The more I dig into Shakespeare with your help, of course, the better I understand. If only two books you possessed were the Bible and Shakespeare, you would be fully, truly educated." How nice. That's really important. And we're going to have a little bit more education with today's program as well. "Thanks to you, there's a raging fire in my bones, not just for the masterful writings of Shakespeare, but for all great works of the past. Have a great day, Andre." So thank you very much, Andre, and keep those comments coming. I'm really excited about that. And the more we're going to get into this, by the way, the more exciting I think it's going to be for everyone. And then we just finished our summer camp here at the college. We had 120 young teenagers on campus. They were singing. They were having a lot of fun. The weather was absolutely perfect. It was cool. I mean, it was just amazing. All the campers are gone. Now it's blasted hot again. It's like 100 degrees almost all day long. So, but anyway, there's no singing. Everyone's mopey and upset because it's too hot. So on our last program, now we are into the tragedy of Richard II, and it is really a tragedy. And the title of today's program is Bolingbroke Returns to England. And so I've been warning you this is going to happen, and certainly it did. But on our last program, I discussed Act 2, Scene 1, beginning on pages 29, 30, 31, and 34. So if you missed, haven't listened to that podcast yet, you can go back and start reading and then get back into, remember, though, all the podcasts are available all the time. So what I was doing with last week's program is I wanted to reveal the importance of Richard's uncle and the younger brother to John of Gaunt. And that is, I'm speaking about the Duke of York. And he was Richard's uncle. And he really took over for his brother. Once John of Gaunt died, he took over to help Richard. And, you know, again, as we go through this a little bit more today, I'll show you that Richard, he didn't like Gaunt. He doesn't like York either. And so one of Richard's cousins is the character Lord Armoral. Now, Lord Armoral is actually York's son. And so he's going to come up. If you remember back a couple programs, I said I was going to read you more about Armoral. And what I want to do is I want to wait when we finally get him into play. And that's going to be pretty soon. But Lord Armoral is York's son, and as we'll see as we get into play, York and Armoral, they go at it because York does not appreciate the fact that Armoral is involved with Richard. Now, I also discussed the entrance of the character, the Earl of Northumberland, and there's really a lot more to him. I pulled out some more information on him that we are going to cover today. Now, today, I want to continue with Act 2, Scene 1, beginning at the bottom of page 37. Now, these lines reveal the power of leadership housed in the Earl of Northumberland. And he is a very, very important character, and he's going to come up in more than just this play. Now, before I get into that, I want to go to the bottom of page 37, and I want to review just a short review, starting about line 215. So if you go back to page 37, if you have your book there, hopefully you're going to be reading right from your book. But if you go to page 37 and we start at line 215, this is the king, and he's arrogant. I think all of you know that by now. And if I haven't said that enough, I'll continue to say it. He's really arrogant. He thinks he's tough stuff. He's 20 years old, by the way. And he's, bossing uncles that have been, through all kinds of tragedies and problems and changes. And they were great leaders. And he doesn't want any help from them. So on line 215, this is the king. And he's talking to his friends. There's Bushy, there's Green, there's Bagot, and sometimes I change the first letter of his name because of what he is. And I'll let you figure that out yourself. I'm not going to say it out loud. But the king says, "Go, Bushy, to the Earl of Wiltshire straight. Bid him repair to us to Ely House to see this business. Tomorrow next, we will for Ireland, and tis time, I trow, or it's time. I believe I do this war." And so, and he says, "And we create in absence of ourself our uncle York, Lord Governor of England, for he is just and always loved as well." And he says, "Come on, our queen, tomorrow we must part, be merry, for our time of stay is short." Now, all that is a big fat lie. he doesn't love his uncle York, and what he's really doing here is really, really quite heinous. He has no respect for him at all. Now, remember, Richard showed incredible disrespect for his uncle York by making him governor of England while Richard went to war with the Irish. Now, you can go back and on pages 36 and 37. And, of course, John of Gaunt is dead. York knows he's dead. York knows that Richard's in trouble. And York is wanting to help him like Gaunt did. And he gives him a tough warning at the top of page 37. He even produces a York prophecy that, look, things are going to be bad for you if you continue what you're doing. And so essentially then, what the king does, instead of wanting to obey his uncle, he makes him governor of England, so he has to obey him. I mean, it's horrible spite. What a nephew would do to an uncle. And this is such great disrespect. And I have this written down here. I says, remember, Richard showed incredible disrespect for his uncle York by making him governor of England while Richard went to war against the Irish. Richard did this spiteful act because he does not want to obey York, so he has made York to obey him. And I'll tell you what, I would never have done that to my Uncle Bud. You know, my poor Uncle Bud, though, is, I think I even mentioned that he was such a great guy. We all loved him. And, but he had serious cancer and it was not able to be fixed and he was dying. And so, essentially he committed suicide. So that was really too bad. It's really upsetting to all of us that when that happened. And I'll just go on to just keep reading here what I've written. Now, this is what I've written, by the way. Richard did this despite his uncle's warnings. But we will soon see that Richard will eventually have to obey the Earl of Northumberland. And that's coming in this play. And, you know, what we're going to do now, we're just going to briefly go down to the bottom of page 37. And I want to introduce a little bit more on Northumberland again. But if you just go down, we're going to go down to, I think it's like line 224 or something like that at the bottom. But essentially, the king and the queen and Armrell and Bushy and Green and Bagot, they all take off the stage. And then Northumberland shows up on the stage and he's with some other lords. And now you don't, when you're reading, you know, Shakespeare, you don't have the gift of a, like seeing a play or seeing, you know, a film of it. But essentially all those characters go off stage and then Northumberland is there with some of the other lords. And they've all been kind of hiding in the background. And this is what, if we just start at the very bottom, it would be about 224. Northumberland says, "Well, lords, the Duke of Lancaster is dead." And essentially, but the actual timing of this scene is about a year after Gaunt has died. So there's already been a year has gone by since Gaunt died. And so can you imagine what Richard was doing without Gaunt? You know, it was not going very well. So remember now, the John of Gaunt died in February 1399. And so Northumberland is kind of, you know, talking with these two other lords about what are they going to do with Richard. Now Ross says, "And living too, for now his son is Duke." So this is the way kind of Shakespeare is trying to get us to see how these people maybe looked at it, is that, yes, the Duke of Lancaster is dead. But what they're saying now is there's a new Duke of Lancaster. And that would be Bolingbroke. And so essentially they're saying, what are we going to do to help Bolingbroke? That's what's really going on here. And essentially what they're saying is John of Gaunt is living now through his son. And so that is really an interesting way of looking at it. Now, what I want to do is I want to go to another history source just for a few minutes. And this is from Peter Saccio. And actually, Peter Saccio has written this incredible book called Shakespeare's English Kings. And that's essentially what I've named my class in here at the college. I call it Shakespeare's English Kings class, and that's for juniors and seniors, and that will be actually starting in the next couple of weeks. So I can't believe classes are starting. I wanted to thank the registrar because they worked it out where I have classes 4 mornings a week. That's it. And I have Wednesday to do the programs. So my Wednesday is free. And so all my classes are on the mornings, and then that gives me afternoons to work for the class the next morning. So it's really a great schedule. So here's what Saccio says with related to these lines, and I'll be reading more of it, and maybe even in the future I'll give you a title so that you can find this book. It's an older book, but you can find it in used bookstores. It's really a great book. But this will really up-to-date us a little bit. This is page 26 of Saccio's book. It's called Shakespeare's English Kings. And to really understand these plays, for all of you out there, is you really need to understand the history as well, because some of it doesn't make sense unless you know what the history is. But he takes us back. This is page 26. He takes us back to the whole scene, whole ridiculous scene between Bolingbroke and Norfolk. And he just updates us. He says, Norfolk left England and died at Venice within a year. So, I mean, he wasn't coming back anyway, but he was dead within a year. Bolingbroke, his exile reduced to 6 years just before his departure, took up residence at the French court. During the time of the quarrel and for 6 months after, in conclusion at Coventry, Richard embarked on a series of financial exactions. Now, we've talked about these already. He secured from Parliament an unprecedented lifetime grant of the customs on wool and leather. Now, that doesn't come out in the play, but not only was Richard, taxing the people, he was increasing his own salary for being king. And so the guy is really criminal. And honestly, I have to be careful what I say here, but it's not much different in the United States right now. You know, we could easily say Richard is a woke leader and he's doing what he wants with the economy. I mean, he's taking what England is earning off the industry of the sheep and all that. He's taking it. And, everything we've seen over the last couple of weeks has just been absolutely mind-boggling, you know, with America. But, Richard was just incredibly evil. It said he secured from Parliament an unprecedented lifetime grant of the customs on wool and leather. He required men and even counties associated with the appellants rising to buy costly pardons. And so when we're going to read a little bit more on this, is that here is the lords of the land. They know England is going down, and he's going after them. You know, he's trying to imprison them. Have we seen that around the United States these days? Absolutely. So it said he forced prominent persons to affix their seals to blank charters, whose contents he eventually intended to fill in when it suited him. Much of the money thus gained he spent on magnificent living. By way of Holinshed, now that's another historian, these activities become the farming of the realm. So when Shakespeare used that in the play, he got that from Holinshed. And he says, and the ostentation vanities for which York and the dying gaunt rebuke Richard in Shakespeare's play. So the thing is Shakespeare has a really unique way of bringing it all out. Says, upon Gaunt's death in February 1399, the king made his greatest mistake, illegally extending the authority of the parliamentary committee set up to deal with Bolingbroke-Norfolk quarrel. He had them revoke the license, enabling Bolingbroke's attorneys to claim the Lancastrian inheritance on behalf of the exiled heir. Have you ever seen anything like that in America? Yes, you have. It's happening right in front of our faces. Is King Richard took control of Bolingbroke's attorneys that were fighting to have him keep his land and his property and the money of his father. And Richard just wiped out the effect of the attorneys. Isn't that amazing? And so the more I read into this, the more I thought I have to include this in here. So, anyway, Bolingbroke had actually got attorneys to make sure that his claim on the inheritance was going to be sound. And Satya goes on to say, since in default of heirs' property reverted to the crown, Richard had in one stroke seized for himself the greatest patrimony in the kingdom. So, everybody in the kingdom, now they were, not everybody liked Gaunt because he was so wealthy. And you could still see pictures of his old castle, and it was unbelievably big. You know, so this guy was really wealthy, and sometimes wealthy people are hated. And that's why everybody loves me, because I'm not wealthy. I tell my children, there is no inheritance, so shut up. Yeah, anyway. There's enough money to bury me, that's it. You know, so, and if you want to burn me up, that's okay too. Anyway, he said, but Richard had in one stroke seized for himself the greatest patrimony in the kingdom. He turned Bolingbroke into an irreconcilable enemy and profoundly alarmed every other magnate in England. If Richard could thus contrive to steal Lancaster, he could steal any inheritance in the land. And so that's what's really going on. So when we go to the bottom of page 37, and we have Northumberland and Willoughby and Ross all talking, this is what they're talking about. This is what they're getting into, is Richard is out of control, and he could really hurt all of us. And so Northumberland then at the bottom of page 37 says, well, lords, the Duke of Lancaster is dead. And then Ross goes on and says, and living too, for now his son is Duke. And so they go on and says, Willoughby then goes on, this is page 38, barely in title, not in revenues. So Willoughby, you can see that Willoughby, Ross, and Northumberland, they're all concerned about their wealth, what they've gained, what they've inherited, what they've built. And he's saying about poor Bolingbroke, is it's like barely he even has a title, but all of his revenues, his money, his land, his goods, they're all gone. And Northumberland says, richly in both, if justice had her right. And so what Northumberland is saying, where's the justice? Where is the justice? You know, do we have justice in this country? Not for everybody. It's not there. You know, and you stand up against some of the people in government today, you're going to pay. You're going to pay the price. Ross goes on to say, my heart is great, which he means there is my heart is swollen, but it must break with silence ere it be disemburdened with a liberal tongue. And so even Ross, they're these lords, they love England. They love the government. They're just heartbroken by what's going on. And Northumberland says, nay, speak your mind, and let them ne'er speak more that speaks thy words again to do thee harm. So Northumberland is saying, look, there's three of us, we're private, we're not going to tell on each other, say what you need to say, and, you know, that's fine. Get it all out. And then Willoughby then says, tends that thou would speak to the Duke of Hereford. If it be so, out with it boldly, man. Quick is mine ear to hear good towards him. So here, Ross and Willoughby, they're already suspecting that Northumberland has been in contact with Bolingbroke. They're saying, hey, are you in contact with him? Let us know. Let us know what's going on. We're not going to tell anybody. And then Ross says, no good at that I can do for him, unless you call it good to pity him, bereft and gelded of his patrimony. So Ross is really bitter. He's saying, look, you know, what good can we do for him? You know, he's been gelded. In other words, he's castrated from his patrimony. You know, he's like a horse that's been castrated. And then Northumberland comes back and he says, "Now, afore God, to shame such wrongs are born. In him, a royal prince and many more of noble blood in this declining land." So they all realize that England is in trouble. It's in decline. And how much have we heard Donald Trump saying this country is in decline? He says it all the time. And it's the same thing that's going on right now. And it's because of the leadership. And he goes on, "The king is not himself, but basely led by flatterers, and what they will inform merely in hate against any of us all, that will the king severely prosecute against us, our lives, our children, and our heirs." And so he's talking about, these lords are talking about, you know, his buddies, Bagot, Green, even Armoral, and, you know, they're giving him information about the lords, and it's not necessarily true information, but he's slamming them. He's ruining their reputations. And they said, "If they continue to do this and the king listens to it, we're going to get hauled into court and we're going to be prosecuted. That's what's going to happen. And that's going to affect their wives, their children, and their heirs." And then Ross continues and says, "The commons hath he pilled, or you could say skinned, with grievous taxes, and quite lost their hearts. The nobles hath he fined for ancient quarrels, and quite lost their hearts." So here Richard is fighting with some of the other nobles over ancient quarrels, probably from his own family, and he's still fighting them on it. And then Willoughby says, "And daily new exactions are devised." So the more he hears, the more bad news he gets. Man, he just goes right into it and starts, you know, stealing money from them, taking money for them, you know, going after them. Says Willoughby continues then and says, "As blanks, benevolences, and what not what, but what a God's name doth become of this?" And they're just like, what is, I mean, they're really upset. Northumberland says, "Wars hath not wasted it, for ward he hath not, but basely yielded upon compromise. That which his noble ancestors achieved with blows, more hath he spent in peace than they in wars." So Northumberland is really, really coming forward and say, he says he's going to have a war in Ireland. There are no wars. He's going to go up and he's going to compromise with them. He's going to offer them money. He's going to offer them things. You know, in other words, he's going to take our money and he's going to offer it to them. And he's going to say, well, it was a great war. Then Ross says, "The Earl of Wiltshire hath the realm in farm." And Willoughby says, now this is another one of, I guess you would call Wiltshire one of his, what do they call it? What did the Russians call people? Idiots. Useful idiots. I guess Wiltshire is a useful idiot. And, you know, he's working for the king and he's helping to ream in the farm or reel it. You know, he's bringing in the money. And Willoughby says, "Then the king's grown bankrupt like a broken man." Northumberland says, "Reproach and dissolution hangs over him." Ross then says, "He hath not money for these Irish wars, his burdensome taxation notwithstanding, but by the robbing of the banished duke." Then Northumberland says, "His noble kinsman, most degenerate king." And what he's, I mean, really, Bolingbroke is a prince. I mean, he's not that far from Edward III. That's the point. You know, John of Gaunt, his dad was the son of Edward III. He's the son of John of Gaunt. You know, so he's definitely in the royal line. He says, "But lords, we hear this fearful tempest sing, yet seek no shelter to avoid the storm. We see the wind sit sore upon our sails, and yet we strike not, but securely perish." Then Ross says, "We see the very rack that we must suffer, and unavoided is the danger now for suffering so the causes of our rack." And then Northumberland, he comes in, like he said, I want you to see his leadership. He says, "Not so. Even though the hollow eyes of death, I spy life peering, but I dare not say how near the tidings of our comfort is." And then Willoughby says, "Nay, let us share thy thoughts as thou dost ours." And so essentially what Northumberland does there, he's revealing his thoughts on things, and essentially He said, look, there's tidings, good tidings are coming. And essentially you're going to, I mean, by now you probably all figured it out. He's already been in touch with Bolingbroke. That's what he's hiding. And Willoughby and Ross want to know, okay, who are you talking to? And he says, Willoughby says, nay, let us share thy thoughts as thou dost ours. They, Willoughby and Ross are saying, look, we've exposed ourselves to you. Now you need to come up. Come on. Yeah, cough it up. Tell us what's going on. And Ross says, be confident to speak, Northumberland. We three are but thyself, and speaking so, thy words are but as thoughts. Therefore be bold. And Northumberland says, then thus, I have from Le Port Blanc, a bay in Bretagne, received intelligence that Harry, Duke of Hereford, Reynold Lord Colban, the son of Richard, Earl of Arundel, the late broke from the Duke of Exeter, his brother, Archbishop late of Canterbury, Sir Thomas Erpingham, Sir John Ramsden, Sir John Norby, Sir Robert Warriton, and Francis Coynt. All these well furnished by the Duke of Bretagne, with 8 tall ships, 3,000 men of war, are making hither with all due expedience, and surely mean to touch our northern shore. Perhaps they had ere this, but that they stay, the first departing of the king for Ireland. And so essentially what Northumberland said is, remember now, Bolingbroke had spent his time in France. The English and the French were tied together through marriage and relationships. And, they say the money is coming and the war is going to be starting. And essentially, in France, all of this started when the king left for Ireland. All the planning, it all fell into place. And so you can see that Bolingbroke, when he got over there, he didn't necessarily listen to his dad and just, pretend that the flowers were women and that, that if it was really cold and you could go up into the, you could run around naked and be warm, kind of stuff like that. He says, he goes on, that perhaps they had ere this, but that they stay the first departing of the king for Ireland. So this is when it all began. If then we shall shake off our slavish yoke, imp out our drooping country's broken wing. And the country's broken wing is the king. That's the point. He's the broken wing. It's like a chicken, or a little hen that has the broken wing. The king is broken. He says, redeem from broken prawn the blemished crown. Wipe off the dust that hides our scepter's guilt. And make high majesty look like itself. Away with me and post to Ravenspur, but if you faint, as fearing to do so, stay and be secret, and myself will go. Here Northumberland said, look, I'm going to be meeting him. I'm going to meet him. If this is too scary for you, just stay back, but keep your mouth shut. And he said, if you can't go, if you're afraid to go, stay and be secret, and I myself will go. Then Ross says, to horse, urge doubts to them that fear. And Willoughby says, hold my horse, and I will first be there. So they're saying, nope, we're going with you. We're going to have to do this. And so I think that's really interesting. And the jig is up for, it's going to be up pretty close for Richard. All right, I do want to just take a little bit more, because this is an hour-long program today. I wanted to do a little bit more on Northumberland. And this this little bit of history I have, again, I think the reason I want to bring it in is because it's so similar to what's happening in America today. But I found this history. It's really pretty good. It's called place I got it from is ShakespeareInHistory.com. And you can look that up yourself. It's www.ShakespeareInHistory.com. And again, with the Shakespeare plays, you really do need to understand the history. And this is a little bit of history on Henry Percy, Earl of Northumberland. And I think it's good at this point to bring this in. I'm not going to read all of this to you. because, you know, we're going to get a lot of it out of the play anyway. But this is the title is Northumberland History. It says the achievements of Henry Percy are relatively minor during the first 35 years of his life. His family had long been considered border lords, those who lived on the Anglo-Scottish border and defended England from Scottish invasions. And Henry continued the Percy tradition by doing his part in fending off the Scots. He came into his inheritance upon the death of his father in 1368, and he participated in the wars in France during Edward III's reign. So you can see that even Henry Percy was a young warrior at the time of Edward III. So these guys all knew each other. He says he was, during that war in France, he was under Edward III's reign, under the commander of the king's son, John of Gaunt. So it's interesting that John of Gaunt was one of his leaders in the war with France. And so he was under that authority. He said it was not until the reign of Richard II, though, that Percy would gain any real influence in the kingdom. He participated in the Good Parliament, the last held under Edward III, and upon the accession of Richard was created Earl of Northumberland and Marshal of England. And so the thing is that this Earl of Northumberland, Earl of Northumberland, was involved with the family, with the royal family. And he said, this goes on to go on to say, the next 20 years saw the continued use of the Percy family as lords of the North. Northumberland, his son Hotspur, or Henry Percy, and we're going to be getting into him in the future plays coming, and his brother Thomas Percy, later Earl of Worcester, were looked at as English defenders against the Scots. Percy quarreled a bit with John of Gaunt at one point when he was assigned to take more of a role in the north, and the family suffered significant defeat at the Battle of Otterburn, where Hotspur's army was defeated and he was captured. In addition, the Percys most certainly had competition as wardens of the Scottish marshes, namely from the Nevilles and the Cliffords. Now, the Nevilles are going to come in these plays that we're going to be covering the next couple months, and the Nevilles were known as the Kingmakers, and so that's going to come up in the future. Now, this is what I think is really important. Despite the numerous problems the Percys faced, Northumberland continued to be an influential figure in England. By the late 1390s, however, he and his family began to grow unhappy with the way in which Richard was handling the border situation. So there is a border situation. What does America have right now? The biggest border situation. And Richard was not handling it well. And they were getting dumped on. They had to figure it out and work it out. And it goes on to say, talking about Richard, he continuously left them out of truce negotiations and other important issues. So they're supposed to be the keepers of the border, and they're not invited to any meetings. You know, how much has that been happening, you know, with people in America? He said, it is this disgruntlement on the part of the Percys that most likely caused them to put their support behind Henry Bolingbroke in 1399. All right, so that's all I'm going to read of this today, because there's more that we can use later. All right, this is really, really, really interesting. All right, we still have some time here. So now you know what's going on, and it's unfortunately it's repeating itself today. All right, so let's move on now to Act Two, Scene Two, and this is another very interesting part of this play. And this is enters the Queen, Bushy, and Bagot. Now remember, these the Queen, in some ways, even if when you're reading this, you're not really sure where she stands on certain things. But then she's hanging around with Bushy and Bagot. These are the two friends of her husband. And the Bushy says, Madam, your majesty is too much sad. You promised when you parted with the king to lay aside life-harming heaviness and entertain a cheerful disposition. So obviously, Richard has put Bushy and Bagot in charge of his wife. And the queen says, to please the king I did, to please myself, I cannot do it. Yet I know no cause why I should become such as a guest as grief, save bidding farewell to so sweet a guest as my sweet Richard. Yet again, methinks, some unborn sorrow, ripe in fortune's womb, is coming towards me, and my inward soul with nothing trembles at something it grieves more than with parting from my lord the king. So in some ways, here the queen is saying, I suspect something really bad is going to happen with my husband. That's what she's afraid of. And so, in other words, she's feeling the impact of prophecy because she's living it. And then Bushy says, each substance of a grief hath 20 shadows, which shows like grief itself, but is not so. For sorrow's eyes glaze with blinding tears, divides one thing entire to many objects. So here we have Bushy is trying to perk up the queen. He's probably afraid of Richard himself if he comes back and she's all, a mess. He goes on to say, like perspectives which rightly gazed upon show nothing but confusion, eyed awry, distinguished form. So your sweet majesty, looking awry upon your lord's departure, find shapes of grief more than himself's to wail, which looked on us as it is not but shadows of what it is not. This sounds like some other political figure that we also are getting to know right now. I call that word salad. What's he even talking about? Then, thrice gracious queen, more than your lord's departure, weep not. More's not seen, or if it be, 'tis with false sorrow's eye, which for things true weeps, thinks imaginary. He says, you got something imaginary in your brain. Forget it. You've got too much imagination. The queen then responds, it may be so, but yet my inward soul persuades me it is otherwise. However it be, I cannot but be sad, so heavy sad, as though on thinking on no thought I think, makes me with heavy nothing faint and shrink. And so there is really good Shakespeare rhyming couplet. He's a master at it. And Bushy says, 'tis nothing but conceit, or what they mean there is imagination. It's just your imagination, my gracious lady. The queen says, 'tis nothing less. Imagination is still derived from some forefather grief. Mine is not so, for nothing hath begot my something grief, or something hath a nothing that I grieve. 'Tis in reversion that I do possess. But what is it that is not yet known? What I cannot name. To nameless woe I wot. And so she's saying, look, there's something more going on here that she senses. And then enter Green. Green enters, says, God save your majesty and well met, gentlemen. I hope the king is not yet shipped for Ireland. And the queen says, why hopest thou so? 'Tis better hope he is, for his designs crave haste, his haste good hope. Then wherefore dost thou hope he's not shipped? And the queen says, that he, our hope, might have retired his power and driven into despair an enemy's hope, who strongly has set footing in this land. The banished Bolingbroke repeals himself, and with uplifted arms is safe arrived at Robinspur. And then this freaks her out. So he's already back on the soil. He's in Ravenspur. And the queen says, now God in heaven forbid. And Green says, ah, madam, 'tis too true. And that is worse. The Lord Northumberland, his son, young Henry Percy, the lords of Ross, Beaumont, and Willoughby, with all their powerful friends, are fled to him. And so things are really happening. And, essentially, Ross, Beaumont, and Willoughby, they're all great northern families. That's in the north. They're on the border with Northumberland. And they're powerful people. He said, the lords of Ross, Beaumont, and Willoughby, with all their powerful friends, are fled to him. Bushy says, why have you not proclaimed Northumberland and all the rest revolted faction traitors. And Green says, "We have whereupon the Earl of Worcester hath broken his staff, resigned his stewardship, and to the household servants fled with him to Bolingbroke." So even the Earl of Worcester is now going, and of course he is Northumberland's brother, Thomas Percy. And we can read more about him later in Saccio. So the queen says, "So Green, thou art the midwife to my woe, and Bolingbroke my sorrow's dismal heir. Now hath my soul brought forth her prodigy, and I, a gasping new delivered mother, have woe to woe, sorrow to sorrow joined." So now and she's talking as a woman would, saying, okay, now I'm like a new delivered mother. The baby's come out, and it's not good. Woe to woe, sorrow to sorrow joined. And Bushy says, "Despair not, madam." And then the queen says, "Who shall hinder me? I will despair and be at enmity with cozening hope. He is a flatterer, a parasite, a keeper back of death, who gently would dissolve the bands of life, which false hope lingers in extremity." Now, here comes now the Duke of York. Okay, this is now the new governor of England. And so, also, he's Uncle York. He's also Armoral's father. Remember now, Armoral is totally tied in with the king. But here comes the governor. And the queen says, "With signs of war about his aged neck, oh, full of careful business are his looks. Uncle, for God's sake, speak comfortable words." And York says, "Should I do so? Should I belie my thoughts? Comfort's in heaven, and we are on the earth." Now, that's a pretty good line. Comfort's in heaven, and we are on the earth. I have a little different opinion on that. But it's not my place to bring that up right now. It says, "Where nothing lives but obstacles, cares and grief. Your husband, he is gone to save far off, while others come to make him lose at home. Here I am left to underprop his land, who weak with age cannot support myself. Now comes the sick hour that his excess made. Now shall he try his friends and that flattered him." So York is saying, okay, it's happened what I said was going to happen. I'm stuck with Richard. And Richard is making a mess. And he says, I've got to deal with it. And it's like, he said, now comes the sick hour. So he's already sick. And then the serving man enters. He says, "My lord, your son was gone before I came." Oh, you know what that means. Armoral can't be found. And so York says, "He was? Why so? Go all which way it will. Says the nobles, they are fled, the commons, they are cold, and will I fear revolt on Hereford's side. Sirrah, get thee to Plashy to my sister Gloucester. Bid her send me presently 1,000 pound. Hold, take my ring." Now, again, this is York. He knows he's going to need some money. But the serving man says, "My lord, I forgot to tell your lordship. Today as I came by, I called there, but I shall grieve you to report the rest." And York saying, "Was it, knave? Tell me." And he goes, "An hour before I came, the Duchess died." So York, he's got, oh man, things are really, there's a lot of problems now. And unfortunately, you know, that's probably going to happen to America. You know, there's going to be things happen that we don't want to happen, but they're going to happen. York then says, "God for his mercy, what a tide of woes comes rushing on this woeful land at once. I know not what to do. I would to God, so my untruth had not provoked him to it. The king had cut off my head with my brothers. What are there no posts dispatched for Ireland? How shall we do for money for these wars? Come, sister, cousin, I would say, pray pardon me. Go, fellow, get thee home, provide some carts, and bring away the armor that is there." So York says, "Okay, looks like there's war. Go get my war equipment. Gentlemen, will you go muster men? If I know how or which way to order these affairs, thus disorderly thrust into my hands, never believe me. Both are my kinsmen. 'Tis one is my sovereign, whom both my oath and duty bids defend. The other again is my kinsman, whom the king hath wronged." So York is really torn up over all this. It's a family affair. It's a family problem that's happening. And he just says, I mean, he has such respect for the office of Richard. He says, "One is my sovereign, with whom I my oath and duty bids defend. The other again is my kinsman, whom the king hath wronged." He's talking about Bolingbroke, "whom conscience and my kindred bids to right. Well, somewhat we must do. Come, cousin, I'll dispose of you." And then he goes, "Gentlemen, go muster up your men." And so here, what essentially what York wants to do is he wants to go meet Bolingbroke. He wants to go and see what's really, really happening. And he's telling them to get some men together. And in other words, he's getting a little mini army together in case Bolingbroke really wants to fight him. And so he's trying to get ready for that. So he's a pretty wise man. He says, "They meet me presently at Berkeley. I should go to Plashey too, but time will not permit. All is uneven and everything is left at 6 and 7. Now, that's a British phrase, or maybe we could call it a Shakespeare phrase, but when everything is left at 6 and 7, that means everything is in confusion. 6 and 7. When I was learning math, 6 and 7 was always confusion to me. So anyway, the Duke of York exits, the Queen exit, Bushy leaves, Bagot leaves, Green leaves, and then Bushy starts talking here. Now, you can see how brave these guys are. In just a few seconds. We still have a little bit of time to get through this. "Do you think they're really strong, mighty men?" "No, they're not." Bushy says, "The wind sits fair for news to go for Ireland, but none returns. For us to levy power proportionate to the enemy is all impossible." So Bushy says, "I'm not getting involved." Green says, "Besides, our nearness to the king in love is near the hate of those who love not the king." Bagot says, "And that's the wavering commons, for their love lies in their purses, and whose empties them by so much fills their hearts with deadly hate." So Bagot, they're all looking at each other. I guess you could almost call them the white dudes. You know, that's the new thing right now with Kamala Harris. The men, the white dudes for Kamala. So that's really pretty interesting. It says, Bushy goes on, "Wherein the king stands generally condemned, Bagot, if judgment lie in them, then so do we, because we have ever been near the king." So here Bagot says the secret part out loud. And he says, "We're in big trouble, guys. We've been with the king. And if he's in trouble, we're in trouble." And they know Bolingbroke is a tough guy. he's not a wimp. And they are. They are the wimps. And then Bagot says, "If judgment lie in them, then so do we, because we have ever been near the king." Green says, "Well, I will it for refuge straight to Bristol Castle. The Earl of Wiltshire is already there." Bushy then says, "Thither I with you, for little office will the hateful commons perform for us. Except like curs to tear us all to pieces, will you go along with us?" Bagot says, "No, I will to Ireland to his majesty. Farewell, if heart presages be not vain. We three here part that never shall meet again." And so Bagot says, "I'm going to go, you know, get to Richard and tell Richard what's going on. But I don't think we're ever going to see each other again. Because they know the gig is up." Bushy says, "That's as York thrives to beat back Bolingbroke." You know, so what they're saying is York is going to beat back Bolingbroke. That's not what York wants to do at all. That's not what he wants to do at all. Green says, "Alas, poor Duke, the task he undertakes is numbering sands and drinking oceans dry. Where one of his side fights, thousands will fly. Farewell at once for all and ever." And then Bushy says, "Well, we may meet again." And Bagot says, "I fear me never." And so they're saying that Bushy's trying to get a little bit of hope in it, saying, "Yeah, we might meet again." And so the point is, they're not really sure what's going to go on. Okay, we could start briefly start into Act 2, Scene 3. And then, actually, this is where Bolingbroke walks on stage. He's back. He's back in England. And he is the Duke of Hereford. And he is with Northumberland. And so these are tough guys. Now, this is actually another key moment in this play. And if you look at the history, it's probably happened around July 1399. And so Bolingbroke is now, he's back in England. And he goes to Northumberland and he says, "How far is it, my lord, to Berkeley now?" So there, I mean, he's got an army. He's got a huge army with him. And he's ready to start fighting to get his land back. And Northumberland says, "Believe me, noble lord, I am a stranger here in Gloucestershire. These high, wild hills and rough, even uneven ways draws out our miles and makes them wearisome. And yet your fair discourse hath been as sugar, making the hard way sweet and delectable." And he said, "I'm not really familiar with Gloucestershire, but because of you, it's like been really sweet to be out here doing it, getting ready for you." And, you know, you can see that Northumberland does have some real care and love for Bolingbroke. And he says, "But I bethink me what a weary way from Ravenspur to Cotshill will be found. In Ross and Willoughby, wanting your company, which I protest hath very much beguiled the tediousness and process of my travel." So Northumberland he's not really picking on Ross and Willoughby. He's just saying, look, that, you know, they're not coming as fast as they really should. He said, "But there's a sweetened with hope to have the present benefit which I possess. And hope to joy is little less in joy than hope in joy. But this the weary lord shall make their way seem short, as mine hath done by sight of what I have, your noble company." So then Bolingbroke says, "Of much less value is my company than your good words. But who comes here?" And enters then Henry Percy. And Northumberland said, "This is my son, young Harry Percy, sent from my brother Worcester, whencesoever. Harry, how fares your uncle?" And, you know, if you look at it here, the brother Worcester refused to declare Bolingbroke a traitor. And I think that was a good thing. And so there are other parts of the Northumberland clan that are really supportive of Bolingbroke. Percy then goes on to say, "I thought my lord to have learned his health of you." And Northumberland said, "Why is he not with the queen?" And Percy said, "No, my good lord, he hath forsook the court, broken his staff at office, and dispersed the household of the king." So remember now, this is his brother. Worcester is his brother. So, make a mark in your book, page 48. That's about all the time we have for today's program. And so, on our next podcast, we will continue with Act 2, Scene 3. And again, enjoy the history. Think a lot about it. And again, there's a lot of more exciting things coming in this play. So please write me any comments you may have to comments@kpcg.fm. You can also comment at my Twitter page, which is titled Shakespeare's Royal Education. Now, you may also be able to find a good used Pelican copy of Richard II at Amazon. And I've looked on there and I've seen Pelican copies for $8 and $9. And so also I'm suggesting to you that you find a good used copy of David Starkey's Crown and Country at Amazon. So thanks for joining me next time as we advance our royal education.
You've been listening to Shakespeare's Royal Education on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.